Okay, Merle's date of birth, please.
March 27th, 1946.
Okay. But she was born and you were still in London.
I got back in time.
Oh, you did get? Yeah. Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, I got back in November. Uh-huh. Then, you know, when I went over, we didn't know the war would be up this fast, and I came back. I went out of Queen Elizabeth, came back out of the Queen Mary, and arrived, what was it, something like November 9th, 1945, which was one of the earliest ships back. And I remember in New York Harbor, there was a tugboat that greeted us with the Andrews sisters singing to us in Las Vegas. I will never forget that feeling. I mean, the place almost melted with tears.
I'm sure.
6,000 times.
I'm sure. Do you want to tell us how the Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth were as troop carriers? They certainly
weren't. Queen Elizabeth was great because went over where there were a few going in that direction in July of 1945. I was there July, August, September, you know, about 4 months. So you can imagine the Queen Elizabeth with about 100 people on board. Coming back, the Queen Mary had 6,000, which was very crowded. And I was in a stateroom with six of us in the stateroom. And these portholes that have the staterooms. And I remember in Southampton looking out, and there were the gray ladies, the Red Cross ladies, and, you know, they had donuts involved. So it was like a donut, and they skimmed it across. I thought it was like some milk, and they had these little cartons of, you know, half a pint of milk. So she threw it, it hit the top of the ship and doused me. And there was no way of taking a shower for 5 days. So I went across the Atlantic. My clothes.
Oh dear, and okay.
But it was happy. It was
I should say. That, and could Roz and the baby join you after?
Overseas?
No, when you came to write Patterson.
Once I came back, I started, I had 60 days rest and recuperation from 4 months of service overseas. And then I took leaves. And I just wasn't away very much until they started talking about giving me the option to stay in the service, stay in civil service, or leave. And I chose to leave and came back.
So they stayed in New York the whole
yeah.
time. They did not go to Wright-Patterson with you.
That's right, because I was in New York most of the time between then and the day I retired.
Okay. I think we'll ask you the names and birth dates of your other children before we go on with your career. What came after Merle?
Emily.
And when was she born?
April 2nd, 1950.
Okay.
Then there was Jacqueline. And she was born on March 12th. She's 36 from 1956.
Okay.
And then Carolyn, Carolyn, was May 9th, 1957.
So you have four girls.
Four girls.
And Roz.
And Roz.
You're the king.
And four sons-in-laws and seven grandchildren.
Wow. I should say. Well, we'll talk about them a little later. Let's go on with your career.
Okay.
What happened after you got out of the Army? You went back to New York.
Well, since I had been a civil service employee, a Chemical Warfare Service when I left, I was entitled to be reemployed as a returning veteran. So I checked and they offered me a position, something in government that was just not interesting. And I did take one as a personnel something for one of the reemployment units, I forget what it was called, where they were trying to employ, get jobs for returning veterans. So I was a counselor for that for a while, until I got a call from a friend of my father-in-law's who was a physician living in Connecticut, he had, he was interested. There were two lawyers in Connecticut who were interested in starting a chemical factory to produce saccharin, and they needed a chemist who would know how to do it. And I went with Roz and my six-month-old baby, with limited knowledge of chemistry by then, but I figured I could check the literature and learn how to produce saccharin. I set up a plant, a small plant, and couldn't get the raw materials because Monsanto was the primary producer of saccharin, and they were getting all the critical materials from DuPont, and they wouldn't sell me any. So I then had to figure out what to do with the equipment, and I learned how to make acid aniline, and I was then in competition with National Aniline, where their sale price for acid aniline was less than the cost of the raw materials. So the next thing I did was liquidate the company.
Liquidate your company?
Well, it was the lawyer's company,
right,
but I
right.
was the chief chemist, chief bottle washer, chief everything. And we returned to, we lived in Saber, Connecticut at the time, a little house. And we returned to New York City with our tails between our legs.
Well, isn't there the company, do you remember?
Essex Chemicals.
Essex Chemicals. How could they sell something for less than the price that they bought the raw materials? I mean, that doesn't sound very
well,
practical.
You know, if you're a national analyst, an international company, and you buy truckload, you know, millions of pounds of the raw materials, you get a different price than if you buy a small amounts.
And were they making other things also?
Oh, yeah, many other things.
I see.
Yeah.
So it got lost.
So,
okay.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, here was a kid with a very small capitalization from these attorneys competing with, you know, I didn't know any better, but, you know, I learned something about business that don't do it that way.
Okay, then what happened?
Acid aniline.
We can talk about that later.
Yeah.
Tapes.
Okay.
Okay.
Next.
So what happened then?
Next, I was looking for a job.
Yeah. You know? Right.
And I found one in New York City at InterScience Publishers, and they hired me as a scientific editor. And that was the beginning of my real career.
What year was that, do you remember?
1947, something like that. Okay. Do you have my Vita Handy?
Somewhere, yeah.
Well,
late
40s,
okay.
Anyway, and I was put in charge of a group of copy editors for manuscripts and journal articles, the things that InterScience Publishers published. One of the books that I was responsible for editing was a book on surface active agents, later called detergents.
Hmm.
By two people, Anthony Schwartz and James W. Perry. James W. Perry happened to be the one who spent most of the time with me in working on this manuscript. We got to know one another very well. We worked on an index to the book in a new field, especially difficult to do. And I had learned indexing. I was the resident indexing expert for InterScience Publishers. And we got to know one another so well that finally he said to me, you know, you look like just a crazy type of guy who might accept the offer I'm going to make. He was at MIT. I need a research associate at MIT. We're in a new field that we're trying to start, trying to develop the theory for it, you know, that we develop. And I was the crazy kind of guy that picked up and left with our two kids, wife and two kids, and moved to Cambridge, well, to Arlington, Mass. enjoy them. It wasn't till later that I learned that we were part of what was called the Center for International Studies of MIT, a large activity, which it turned out, I found out later, was totally financed by the CIA. And the CIA obviously interested in anything new related to information technology and development of theories about how to handle information, and that's why we were financed by that. So after being there for a while, we started working on experimental machines of various sorts, and, well, there's a lot of that that can come later. And they wanted me to come to Washington as a consultant to CIA to start applying some of the things that we'd learned. So we picked ourselves up and spent a year in Washington.
Wait, one thing. How long were you at Cambridge?
Let's see. 6-9 months, something like that. But things were moving very fast, and they wanted me down there.
Was that a faculty appointment at Cambridge?
No, research assistant.
It was research, okay.
Yeah, which means they employ you as long as you bring in money.
I see. But the CIA paid for it,
they paid for it.
Okay.
But then the CIA wanted me down there.
I see, okay.
My visa does not list the CIA because I was not permitted at that time to say it.
Interesting.
So it shows MIT through that whole time.
I see. Yeah. How long were you in Washington?
Well, for a year. But 6 months into that year, Harry and I used to come down, and both of us were there. He didn't move. He stayed in Boston. We had a place, a laboratory, with two desks in the front of the laboratory with two extensions of the same phone. Once the phone rang, and someone wanted us both on the phone, and it was Clyde Williams, the president of the Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio. And in his horrible voice, he started saying, I have a dream.
This was before we knew about I Had a Dream, I assume.
Yeah.
Okay.
I created a National Scientific and Technical Information Center here at Battelle, and we've been checking around to find out who are the dominant people who could do this for us, and you're the only ones who can come and try this. So we chatted for an hour, after which time he put on his personnel director, and we chatted for an hour, talking about salary and conditions. And then he came back for an hour, and we agreed to come sight unseen, never having seen the place.
To Columbus, Ohio.
Columbus, Ohio. But we knew the reputation of the Battelle Memorial Institute, a major organization.
No.
So we got there in 19, whatever it says.
53.
And started working. The first project was with Aberdeen Proving Ground, where we were developing a system for them with new equipment that IBM was supposed to manufacture and deliver based on our design. And after about a year and a half, the IBM people came and said they've decided not to manufacture it. We were left with our deep trouble with Aberdeen Proving Ground, because we had developed a system based on the specification for that equipment. But it happened to be the time that they were just deciding to go heavily into computers, and they weren't going to invest in the development of a punch card machine that simulated what a computer could do. Okay. So, Perry got into bad trouble because of that, because with the Battelle management, they wanted him to leave and me to stay. I decided not to do that, and we both made an arrangement to go to Western Reserve in Cleveland, where we were asked by the president to set up a research center and academic program.
What president?
John S. Millis, M-I-L-L-I-S.
He was the president of Western Reserve.
Western Reserve.
Okay.
Okay. And we agreed to do it. It was called the Center for Documentation and Communication Research. And He was director, I was associate director. He was professor, I was associate professor. And we started our program, that our research program, which was very successful. And after a bit, Perry, who was a very difficult person to get along with administrations, was asked to leave. I stayed on. It's funny. And I got tenure at a tender age. And one day I got a call after 8 years at the Western Reserve from Edward Litchfield.
Here at Pitt.
Here at Pitt. And that started a whole year.
Before we get into your time in Pittsburgh, let me ask you a little bit about your social life, yours and Roz's, in these various places, in Columbus and Cleveland. Were you able to make friends quickly? You moved around so much. How did you do it?
Boston was very difficult. We were just beginning to make some friends in the Jewish community when we moved to Washington, the CIA. Just before we were to move, we had an interesting experience. In Arlington, we had taken a two-bedroom apartment for two kids and ourselves, and it was Passover, and we had a little Seder for the four of us, and we were singing songs. The next morning, we got a call from the manager saying we have to leave. We turned out that it was a restricted apartment, and they didn't know because of our name that we were Jewish.
And you really had to leave?
We really had to leave, but it didn't matter because we were going to leave anyway to go to Washington. Yeah. But they didn't know this.
Right.
But, that was before the laws would have made it difficult to do that.
And Columbus?
Columbus, we made some friends in those 2 years. But our real social life began when we were in Cleveland, and a very extensive social life, a lot of good friends. Some of who we still are in contact with. And
did you, at that point, make Jewish contact, Jewish commitments in Cleveland?
Oh, yeah, we belonged to a conservative temple there.
Do you remember the name?
The community. Yes, we did. We belonged to it. That was a period, an interesting period. There was one episode you might find interesting for the story. It was one of the things that we developed that was based on the theories that we had developed at MIT was we wanted to have a machine that would do the work we wanted to do, and with IBM getting out of the picture, we didn't know how to get the equipment we needed. So Perry, who was a very inventive guy, and I helping him, built a relay-operated computer that did precisely what we wanted. And that became the model for a General Electric to build an electronic version of it. That they hopped out of the tube because it was too expensive to do. And they called me into their company headquarters in Tempe, Tempe, Arizona, where they were building it. And here I was, a relatively young guy, faced with, when I came there, I didn't know what they wanted me for. I thought it was just a routine business to check on progress of the machine they were contracted to build. And they, I found a table, a very long table, surrounded by people. Only one of whom I knew, the manager of the activity. And he started by saying, I have to tell you that we have decided to cancel the contract. We will not build it. I showed no emotion because I was so shocked. Here it happened again, you know. And I'm just sitting there looking at them. And finally, Claire Lasher, I remember very well, said, well, what do you have to say? So I started to get up. I said, I have my tickets here. I'm returning completely. I'll have our general counsel go to court and sue the pants off you.
This is GE? Is that
General
G-
Electric?
Okay.
He said, sit down, let's discuss. We're here for a discussion. And I had all kinds of people there from their legal offices in New York and all that. So I said, well, start discussing. Well, we ended up with an agreement that they would build a general-purpose computer and program it to fit the precise specifications that we wanted. That's what we got a couple of years later.
Fantastic. So had you not spoken up, it would have never happened? Is that how you feel?
Well, if you give up, you give up. You know, I mean, that would have been the cheap thing for them. It cost them a bundle to do the software for that. I mean, the specifications were very complicated. And at that that period in the development of the programming art, it was a horrendous job. And I used to visit that every month or so to check to make sure that the program was being developed appropriately.
Now, what year would that have been? I don't
that know was 1958. Early 58. Yeah. Then, the interesting thing happened. I'm sitting in my office. What the heck was it? Back to 1957. I'm sitting in my office. In November, early November, this was right after the Sputnik went up in October 57. We had been going to Washington frequently to try to get grants for our work, and the National Science Foundation was one of the organizations we were constantly attacking, and it was very difficult to get money from them in those days. I recall that we discussed having a conference to discuss the setting up of a national network of information centers that would operate to provide the type of scientific support that presumably the Soviets had that permitted them to beat us in the space area.
Was there any knowledge in the scientific community about Sputnik before it was when
there may have been in the intelligence community, but it wasn't discussed. It was a total surprise.
You did not
to
know.
The people. No, total surprise.
But you knew they were doing stuff like that.
Well, the intelligence community knew that, but this was a closed society.
Right.
So, we decided to have a conference, and I organized this conference. It was the first conference of about 15 that I've organized over the years to discuss this plan that we had for the National Organization of Information Systems. We prepared a document, a booklet, that described the whole thing to be given to all the people attending. These were representatives of government agencies, corporations that were interested in this field, and they would review the document, and based on their comments, we would redo it, and it would then go to to some agency of government to get it funded and all that. The agreement was there was no release of this document to anyone except the individuals who would come to the conference. Okay, a few days before the conference was to be held, our PR director at Western Reserve University called me and said, I have a reporter for the Cleveland Play Dealer. Can you see him? Yeah. He heard about the conference. Can you talk about it? Talked about the conference. He says, can I have the booklet that describes the plan? So I said, no, here it can. He says, oh, come on, find out, call your president and see if he'll change his mind. After all, I've been good to the university all these years. So I called him. He was on his way to the airport to go on a trip. And I said, Jack, I have to do this, you know. So he said, tell him, no way, period. Okay. few days passed, and I'm going to work at the university. I'm driving in, and the 8 o'clock news was on. And you know how you drive, you don't really listen to it. You're coping with traffic. And I hear my name mentioned on the 8 o'clock news in Cleveland. And I didn't hear what they said. Well, anyway, I got to the office, and there were some physical plant people delivering some furniture that I needed. And they said, "Professor Ted, that was some story in the morning newspaper." Well, I hadn't seen it, so I ran and got it. 8 columns across the front page. 8 columns of the plain dealer, WRU, Western University, plans World Document Center. Our PR guy had slipped them the entire proposal ahead of time. Well, it led to a lot of stuff and all that, and it was a major news story. There was no one, there were no murders in Cleveland that day, and that commanded the whole paper with follower stories and all that. Well, shortly after that, I'm sitting in my office, and I get a call, and a vaguely familiar voice says, I'm Senator Hubert Humphrey. What are you guys up to? It turns out this story, you know, when it's in a major U.S. paper, it hits all the wire services, and it hit Washington, and then he got to see it, his staff got to see it, and we started chatting. And he said he was chairman of the subcommittee on government reorganization, and he was trying to set up a Department of Science. And he said, "I'm having a devil of a time from the scientists. They think it's a government takeover. And now this information activity might be a way to make an end around Ron. Can you come down and chat with us?" Obviously.
He said yes.
And we chatted with his staff, and it led to hearings, and it led to a lot of money flowing. It never led to a Department of Science, but we got to know Humphrey pretty well, and his staff even better. And what else can I tell you? Oh, that led then to a lot of notoriety for me, which led then to a call that I got from Jimmy Rand, R-A-N-D, James Rand, who was head of Rand Development Corporation, in a suburb of Cleveland. I had never met him in my life. He gets on the phone one day and said, "I'm calling from New York City." And he told the following story. Khrushchev was then the premier, Eisenhower the president, premier of the USSR, Eisenhower the president. Khrushchev, as every other premier, had contacted the president of the United States to ask for credit on a most favored nation basis, and the answer was no. But however, if there are things that we can share and learn about one another, we might reconsider. So they sent a team headed up by one of the ministers of the USSR, Lesochko. Don't ask me how to spell it. Lesochko. And a team of scientists, and Jimmy Rand was the guy who was, he was chairman of the Council of Inventors for the U.S. By the way, he was with the Remington Rand family, so they got these neat assignments. And he was shepherding them around, and he said, "We've been discussing things we might do, and they mentioned your name. Can you come into New York and meet with them?" Well, I was on a plane in 2 hours and met them and dinner, and it led to an invitation to come and see what they're doing. I spent a month there.
Now, what year was this?
I left at the end of August 1958.
Okay, tell us about what you did.
I'm better.
Okay.
There were Jimmy Rand, myself, his chief physicist, and a fellow by the name of George Bookbinder, who was a lieutenant in the U.S. Army, born in the Soviet Union, or when it was Russia, before it was the Soviet Union, was fluent in Russian, was parachuted down to meet the Russian army, wherever they were meeting the Americans, to be a liaison guide with them and knowing how to speak Russian. Jimmy Rand wanted to be sure that we had our own interpreter along. Well, I had done preparatory work to check on about 30 different people from the literature that I thought it would be important to see related to my field. And I had this list, and we arrived in Moscow. By the way, that was funny. Roz was studying Russian, and she taught me how to count from 1 to 10. They put me on the 11th floor of the hotel.
We hadn't gotten that far.
Well, that's just sidelines. Anyway, where am I?
Now I think you better watch a few things. And now we have to really...
Okay. Jack Matthews.
Yeah, M-A-T-T-H-E-W-S.
Okay. And John Flanagan?
F-L-A-N-A-G-A-N, Flanagan.
Okay, I have that. All right. What I wanted to know was Perry's name. James?
James W. Perry, P-E-R-R-Y.
Okay.